Cosmetic Course Podcast, Episode 6. This is Adrian Richards. I'm a consultant plastic and cosmetic surgeon and the surgical director of Cosmetic Courses. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Ron Myers, who we've talked to before and is a real expert in how to set up your business. And he's going to be talking us through topics such as, you know, assessing your competition, developing a business plan to really give you a good insight in the best ways of getting started. Hello, so I'm here with Ron Myers again, who we've talked to before on previous podcasts. And Ron, one of his specialities is really advising businesses in the aesthetic industry about, you know, how to run most efficiently. So you've seen all sorts of businesses, haven't you, Ron?
Yes, I have, yes. Well, I've been in the market since 1994, and so I suppose I've grown up with, especially the non-surgical aesthetic market, as it's grown forward and become more sophisticated over the last 16 years. And as people have tried different business models, and as the business itself has become more sophisticated in terms of what we can now do to help clients, and also in terms of, obviously, the different ways you can now market any business to potential customers.
So, I mean, you've seen sort of small ones, big ones, failed ones, you know, all sorts of different models. Just tell me about the, you know, some crucial things that you think perhaps people starting their business should really pay attention to.
Well, I probably think the very first thing that people should look at is getting into business for a start, especially if they're a medical practitioner, because a lot of their training and background doesn't necessarily pertain to running a business. So it's to look at why they're getting into business, what they're trying to build, whether this is just a part-time income, where they're looking at dealing with something that may be different from their core work within the NHS, or whether they want to build a full-service medical aesthetic clinic. And I think once they define that, then what they need to do is obviously plan and put together a business plan around that and look at the implications of that business model and the costs involved with it and the risks they're going to take potentially as well. So that's probably the very first.
Yeah, so something I sort of noticed is people don't, particularly medical people, they don't expect to fail.
No, that's true actually.
They sort of assume everything's going to be fine, and they don't really, at the beginning, they sort of jump in before really thinking about it.
Well, I can give you a case point of that, actually, especially in the laser market. There was a company that I won't name, but that used to go around a few years ago and market specifically to general practitioners, and they would pull together a day where they had people talk about the concepts of laser treatment, what they could do to help their patients, clients, the business models, and they also have someone in from a finance perspective who would talk about lease options as well. And believe it or not, some people would sign up on the day to £80,000 worth of debt over a five-year period through a lease option. And we've had some of those people phone us up and say, well, I've done this now. How do I start a business? So clearly, that's not a rational way of approaching, getting into this marketplace. So, yeah, I think people do need to take a step back and look at exactly what they're trying to achieve, look at their competition in their local area, and look at, really sitting down and putting pen to paper and putting together a plan and taking advice from somebody who knows and understands business, whether that's a bank manager or an accountant or whatever, who can give them some good quality advice and help them think through what they're about to do if they're going to make a step into this marketplace.
Okay, so that's maybe the first step. It doesn't, the business plan sounds a bit intimidating, doesn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't really. I mean, in essence, I would think of it as a kind of a thought organizing tool. And a business plan you can get from probably pretty much any bank now who deals with business banking will give you a template for a business plan. And at the end of the day, they are fairly generic. It looks at what your objectives are, what you're trying to do, the market that you're in, the products that you're going to sell, the competition that you may face in your locality. Just really get some thoughts together and some figures together from a cash flow perspective, which is really important. How much money are you going to invest, whether that's just in your training or whether you have to invest in premises and staff and equipment and all those other things, and get that down on a piece of paper so you've got some sort of idea then as to how much it's going to cost, alongside some ideas of revenue, profit, money that you're going to generate through that business. And what most people underestimate, especially if they don't really think about this, is they underestimate the costs and overestimate the money they're going to make.
Yes.
And so it's just a very good process. Even if you're going to go into it, you know, not full time, it's a good process to go through just to organise your thoughts and think, is this going to be worth it for me?
Yeah. So brilliant. I mean, that's sort of the first thing that people just spend a weekend, you know, or a week just thinking about it.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Take advice. Talk to people if you can do or who are already in this business. And there are a lot of actually, you know, fairly friendly people you can network with in this business, especially if you're a doctor or nurse. There are organizations like the BACD or the Aesthetic Nurse Practitioners Group. And there are people there that are quite happy to sort of talk to you about their experiences as well and help to give you some guidelines.
Brilliant. Okay, so after they've spent time researching, you know, what would be the next stage, do you think, Ron?
Well, I think it's the understanding of what makes a successful business. And so it's being able to look at breaking that down in terms of what a business is involved in doing. And so if you're looking at business, the first thing you've got to do when you set up a business is to get customers. So you have to look at that what we call lead generator. You get new customers into your business and make people aware of your services. The next thing is to think about is, okay, when those businesses phone you, which invariably they will do rather than walk in unless you've got some form of retail premises, is to think about who's going to take the phone call. And it's to think about their skill set in terms of what their job is, which is to convert that phone call to an appointment for you if you're a practitioner, to then sit down with that potential client and discuss your services and obviously then try and convince them that you're the best person. So you've got generating new customers and then conversion from an inquiry to a consultation, and then you've got to look at your skill set and whether or not you can convert that consultation into a treatment. Because until that's gone through that process, you haven't got any income. The next thing is to look at, and especially I think with the non-surgical marketplace, and I don't know whether what your views are on this, Adrian, as well, looking at, say, the surgical marketplace versus the non-surgical marketplace. But I think with the non-surgical marketplace here, we're looking at building a repeat revenue business.
Yes.
So in other words, if somebody's coming in for Botox and fillers, this is not just a one-off treatment. You're selling here a concept where people are going to need repeat treatment in order to improve upon and then eventually maintain results over, hopefully, 4, 5, 10, 15, maybe 20-year period, depending on how old they are.
Yes.
And so you've got to look at how you engender in that repeat business into the model, communicate with the clients effectively, book them in for repeat appointments, lots of little tricks there to make sure that you're getting repeat business. The other thing... The other principle that you can look at as well is to look at how you increase the average spend on a customer as well. So, for instance, if you've got a client who's been coming in for the last year and is very happy with Botox injections, but you look at their complexion and the quality of their skin and think, well, maybe there are other things here that can also improve and enhance the way that they look, it could be that you look at a retail range and look at trying to convince them that a retail range, a cosmeceutical range, for instance, that might be more effective and help with their complexion, might be something they might buy into. So then instead of, say, for instance, somebody spending £600 a year on three treatments of Botox for glabellar lines, you could be generating an extra couple of £100 upwards on the retail sales as well. So it's looking at the average spend of the client. And then the other key thing, I think, and this is really important at this point in time in the market, is margins. And that really looks at how much you pay for the treatment that you're delivering and how much money you generate. So, case in point is Botox or botulinum toxin, and I'm sure that a lot of your people who are running, come through your courses as well, will be aware that there are different versions of that with different costs, and there's a lot of debate about which is the best, but ultimately, you're probably looking at, for a good, effective dose for glabellar line, maybe it's going to cost you between sort of £40 to £60 in material costs.
Mm.
If you're going to charge £200, then your gross margins are going to be the material costs minus the money you're generating from the customer. If you're going to charge £99 for Botox, which is what some people are doing, to try and bring people in, then obviously your margins are going to be smaller. So the issue is as well.
Yeah, just another point, Ron. I mean, I think people don't include all the other costs, sort of, you know, answering the phone, insurance, you know, courses you go to. It's not just the cost of the Botox, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you're... And this is why when you look at a service, you have all of those additional costs as well, which is, of course, your time, which you've got to look at and how much you value that, and whether or not you could potentially sell your time through a different enterprise for more money than you can generate through, you know, operating this type of business model, for instance. Rent rates, everything else from a premises perspective, as you say, insurance, there's lots of other things you need to incorporate in that. But in essence, when you look at a particular treatment, you're looking at gross margins, so you're looking at how much I can generate out of that treatment, and preferably on a time basis as well, an hour.
Yeah.
And so for instance, the gross margins, when you're looking at buying in a piece of equipment, you have to consider the cost of running that equipment on a monthly basis.
Yes.
Whether that's the lease cost of, say, £2,000 a month, plus service costs for that piece of equipment, plus any consumable elements as well.
Yes.
And so you need to understand, because to be able to break that down in order to understand how much money you're making on the particular income that you're bringing in for that, because otherwise people think, well, I'm generating £2,000 worth of business through laser hair removal, but they haven't considered that they're paying £2,000 on the lease for the equipment as costs, and they're not making any money.
I know it's a difficult question. What sort of gross margin do you think people should be aiming for?
Well, the more the better. But I think in essence, you're looking at really, and again, you have to relate this to time as well. So it's not just the margin, it's the time it takes to do it. So in other words, say for instance, if you're looking at, say for instance, if we just talk in numbers terms, if you're looking at Botox, for instance, and you say it's going to cost £70 for the actual materials, but you're going to generate £130 if you're going to charge £200 for an area, and you can do that in 15 minutes, then you can work out you've got 4 times 140, you know, in theory. So you're looking at £400-£500 an hour from that perspective. If you're looking at a laser, generally with the time taken and the amount of money you have to pay for that equipment, I would say that it's not worth a doctor being involved in laser hair removal treatments, for instance.
No.
And so you want to devolve that down to a beauty therapist, maybe MEQ level 3, soon to be trained, etc., but where you're only paying them £15-16 an hour.
Would you incentivize them?
I would definitely, yes. And I would look at doing that on a quarterly basis with targets. I would set a minimum target that they needed to achieve, and then bonus them for overachievement of target. So in other words, what I wouldn't do is to give them a percentage of the treatments that they do as a fixed percentage.
Right. So we do that with our practitioners. I mean, so we move to, you know, a sort of percentage of what they earn, they get, basically, they retain. And you know, we've noticed a sort of, you know, a good increase in the number of treatments, you know, we're performing. So that seems to work well.
Well, absolutely. It does incentivize them without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, the other thing as well is not just to look at the practitioners in your business. It might also be the reception side of things as well. And I believe they are a critical component to a business, because lots of people focus on spending sometimes tens of thousands of pounds a month on various marketing activities, whether it's advertising, whether it's internet-related, pay-per-click, public relations or whatever, getting the phone to ring. And if, say, for instance, you have 100 new inquiries a month, but the receptionist is not particularly motivated, doesn't really understand what you're trying to do with the business, is more, say, customer service orientated, rather than having the skill set of thinking, my job is to convert that inquiry to a consultation, they may only convert 50% of the people through. And hence, you've only got 50 people that are coming in. for a consultation. If you could spend a little bit of time and energy just looking at the skill set of that person, and even just measuring it, if you don't measure the conversion, then you need to, because you don't understand how much business you might be missing, and you increase that to 60% conversion, then you get another 10 people coming in a month, and say their average spend is £200, that's an extra £2,000 a month just by sitting down with your receptionist sort of looking at what they do. And I think if you provide some incentive for them to improve that conversion, it could be something as simple as, you know, I will pay you £5 for every person that you get to sit in front of me.
Yes.
Not a large amount of money, but if you look at the economics of that and how much money you can generate out of that person, if that receptionist does get them to come and sit in front of you, it really does add up. And it shows that you value their importance in the business as well.
Yes.
Rather than rather than just looking at the practitioners who do the treatment, the glamour end of the business, if you see what I mean.
Yes, because actually, I mean, if you go to a clinic, you often spend more time with the receptionist than with the practitioner.
I totally agree. And also, they're also the front line usually for dealing with problems and dealing with, having to smooth over issues, which, you know, invariably in any business they can be. So my suggestion always would be to look at someone who has, you know, quite a broad skill set, who's on reception, rather than just someone who's been, you know, involved in some form of customer services role. If they've got any direct sales experience, direct telesales experience, that's even better, because they understand the concepts of a sales process.
Yes.
And so they can deal with effectively the inquiries, which I think increasingly businesses are getting now. And it's a good thing to look at and to talk to your receptionist and say, well, when people phone up, you know, what are they asking? More and more now, I think, because more and more businesses are becoming visible, people are phoning up and saying, how much does it cost?
Yes.
They're buying on price, and this is because I think a lot of people don't understand how to buy these treatments. And so the easiest thing for them to look at is price for a start, and kind of get an idea about that. And a very simple, you know, trick, instead of obviously just giving the price from a reception point of view, which I think some do, is a simple trick is just to, you know, ask them and say, well, you know, a few questions, you know, have you had this treatment before? So they could just be shopping around, they've already had it somewhere else, you know, and you start to get into an engagement about that. Maybe find out who they've been to see. It gives you an idea, if you know your local competition, how much they're already, you know, charging at the moment. The other thing might be to, to also ask them, you know, simple question like, you know, are you looking for the cheapest treatment or are you looking for the best results and best service?
Yes.
You know, immediately then it gets them into a different frame of mind, rather than just thinking about price. And I think most people would look at, you know, the service and the treatment side of things, which then you can obviously build upon from a point of view of the profile of your clinic and your service and the way you deliver these treatments and any points of differentiation you have over your local competitors.
Okay, so I mean, I agree, really important who answers your phone and how it's answered. And any sort of comments about the hours it should be answered, how many rings it should be answered by?
Well, I think generally if you look at people who would run courses on telephone training skills, they would normally say between sort of 2 and 4 rings is the ideal. Not too quick and not too sort of late. I mean, in reality, in a busy practice, of course, it really depends on how many receptionists you have.
Yes.
And, you know, if you only have one receptionist and they're dealing with a client in front of them at that point in time who's coming in for a consultation, you can understand, you know, the difficulty sometimes of adhering to that.
Yes.
So the key thing you have to look at as well is just how busy your practice is. How many people are you potentially missing? So, you know, do you have enough lines in? Does it convert over to a clinic manager if the receptionist doesn't answer it within, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 calls because they're too busy with a client? Lots of different functional things like that. Also, what happens when you're not there? So, say, for instance, at 6 o'clock, if you finish work then, what happens if people phone up in the evenings?
Can I tell you what we do, Ron?
Yes.
So basically, we have a broadband phone system between our clinics, so it can be answered in any of the clinics. So it rings simultaneously in each of the places. Anyone can answer. Now, if the phone is not answered within four rings, it comes through to my mobile.
So that's fantastic.
So I know that it hasn't been answered, and not so that I, you know, I can sort of stamp on anyone. It's basically that I know we need to increase the phone lines or the people answering them.
Which is brilliant. So you've got a handle on one of the, you know, a critical factor in your business, which is if people can't get through, they haven't even got a chance of booking them in for an appointment. And if people don't consider that, then, you know, potentially they are going to miss people and miss opportunities. And, you know, people, it's easy for people to find a local competitor and phone them instead. And if they get through to them, then, you know, it's likely they'll book in with them. The other aspect as well, we've used this in our clinic as well, is to look at an out-of-hours response.
Yes.
System. So there are various companies that operate this, and we do this through a company called Direct Response.
Yep.
And what we found, converted to this, at the weekends, this was a number of years ago now, we used to have just an answer phone.
Yes.
And we found actually very few people left messages on the answer phone. And when we switched across to Direct Response, we found we were missing between 5 and 7 calls every weekend. And these were predominantly actually for new inquiries rather than existing customers phoning up for appointments or for, you know, any particular problems that they had. So from a cost-effective perspective, we found that just worked straight away. And so that actually worked 24/7 for us.
How does that work, Ron? Do they have a script? Do they answer on lots of people's behalf?
Yeah, they have a script. So they have 3 different scripts depending on what the inquiry is. So one of them may be, you know, somebody's inquiring for information or about services, so they have a particular script for that. And obviously the idea is that they don't give information out. They just say, take down the contact details and say, you know, unfortunately somebody's not available at the moment, but they will get back to you on a particular, you know, time or date. If it's a Saturday morning when the inquiry is taken, they will be told that somebody will get back to them on Monday morning, for instance.
Okay. Do they email you this, or how do they?
And it's emailed as well, yeah. So you get, in essence, what you get is the email of the inquiry and all the contact details and any other information they've taken down. Another aspect could be, you know, somebody phoning, you know, a regular client for a new appointment, and again, they'll get a similar message saying that, you know, somebody will get back to them as soon as possible. And the third aspect, which is important as well, I think, is if anyone phones up and has a particular concern, especially if it's an urgent concern. So, for instance, if you've done a lip suction procedure on a Friday afternoon, and somebody's concerned on a Saturday morning, then it goes through to, if it's an urgent inquiry, it'll go through to 3 mobiles until somebody's contacted who will get back to them.
Yes.
So,
brilliant,
you know, it's more of a customer service related thing, but again, it's another thing that you can explain to your clients and say, you know, you can be confident that if you need us, you'll get in touch with us.
Brilliant. Ron, so I think, I mean, that's great. So perhaps in the next podcast, we could discuss sort of, you know, lead generation, the consultation and retention. But thanks very much for joining us today. And, you know, we'll talk to you in the future about these other aspects.
My pleasure, Adrian. Thank you.
Thanks. So thanks again for listening to the podcast. And thanks for Ron for sharing his insights with us. As I've mentioned before, you can subscribe to the podcast so you have it delivered automatically to your iPod, iPhone, or any other digital recorder, so you can listen to it, you know, wherever, in the car, in the gym, wherever's most convenient for you at any time. You can subscribe either via the website cosmeticcourses.co.uk or by going to iTunes and looking for the Cosmetic Course podcasts. If you do go to iTunes, it would be really grateful if you could leave a rating there. Would also really appreciate it if you think of anyone else, perhaps in the industry, who would, you know, value this sort of material that we're producing. You know, please spread the word for us. We've also produced another podcast called the Plastic Surgery Podcast, which is really aimed at surgeons and discusses sort of the latest surgical techniques, you know, to really sort of update us on that. And I'm talking to experts around the world, you know, in particular fields. So thanks again for listening. This is Adrian Richards. Until the next time.